And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 76. It's almost, it's like a bicentennial sort of thing or other. I don't know what's going on. Hey there, Adam Gerke, Tim Hall.
Hey, well,
and Tim,
good to be back.
Look at this. There are two separate bodies in here. Normally we would have Sarah Michelle Fetters, who is sick as a dog right now, wrote us this morning, said, you know what, guys, carry on. I'm losing my lunch or dinner or what have you.
Get well, Sarah.
Horrible fever. So, yes, she's probably listening right now. I'm just like, ooh. Yeah. But there are two other people in the studio with us right now. They also grace the theaters with us. And I'm very excited to have you both here because for years, Matt Lynch, you are one. Aaron Hunley, you are another. Aaron, you are newer to the theater squabble factor. But needless to say, the two of you have both been very present at screenings for some time. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Real quick, Aaron, why don't you give us the lowdown on where you come from? Where do you write? Where can people hear more from you?
Sure. I run my own blog. You can find me at essentiallyaaron.com, essentiallyaaron on Instagram, and Aaron_Hundley on Twitter. My blog contains all of my film reviews, as well as a couple things about just living life and being authentic.
And people,
Seattle.
Grab a pen real quick, because your name is spelled kind of clever. How do we spell your name?
So it's essentially spelled the American way, but Aaron is E-R-Y-N-N-E. I tell people my parents were drunk, but they weren't. They just decided to spell it that way.
Okay.
Wait, so, now, Aaron's being humble. What else do you do?
Oh, I mean, I have like five jobs. I run my own Etsy shop as well.
What?
It's called, Flourish and Ink Blots.
What do you
yes,
make?
Yes, it is named after the bookshop in Harry Potter, Flourish and Blots.
No way.
I make decals.
Whoa.
Yeah.
They're very
stickers.
Cool.
Yeah, I've been doing it for about 2 years now. It's been awesome.
That's very cool. Okay. So that is one of the five jobs.
Yeah. Well, I don't literally work five jobs,
okay.
But it feels like it. Like
all
I start
right, well,
and the sun comes up and I don't end until the sun comes right back up.
We will pull back more layers of this onion skin as we continue. And Matt, tell us a little bit about where you come from.
I work at Scarecrow Video. I'm the marketing coordinator there. You can also find me on Letterboxd under my name, Matt Lynch. You can find me on Twitter at Colonel Mortimer. And I write for a website called InReviewOnline.com.
Holy smokes. So we got heavyweights in here tonight. And this is great. This is actually fantastic. So I'm excited about this. Tim, are you excited about this?
I'm always excited.
All right. Well, that being said, Tim, why don't you give us a little bit of a lineup to what's out in theaters? This was the number one thing.
This is the first movie we're doing today.
Yeah.
Incredibles 2.
You
this
bet.
This is 14 years after the first Incredibles movie, written and directed by Brad Bird. We find the Parr family literally right after we last saw them in the streets fighting Underminer. What was his name?
The Underminer.
The Underminer, yeah. That's correct. Underminer, I knew I was right. And so the superhero thing the government's doing is shut down, and they get approached by these brother and sister to come, and they want to sort of rebrand superheroes. And they pick Elastigirl because she has less casualty rate when she's out fighting crime. And so that leaves Mr. Incredible at home with the children. And then they end up fighting this crazy villain, screenslaver.
Yeah,
I keep wanting to say screenslaver. Screenslaver. They keep finding
screenslaver.
I got you.
They're finding screenslaver, and that's sort of the movie, and it's great.
Okay,
it's great. I loved it. It's everyone says this, and it's so true. It's really the best Fantastic Four movie we ever have. It's better than the other stuff. It's like a family fighting as a family, and you've got these other superheroes who show up with cool powers. Like Void had a really cool. I liked the way they used Void's powers. Like opening portals and dropping people in front of her. Like that was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you guys take? You're both, Matt, you're standing there with your arms crossed.
No, I'm standing here with my arms crossed anyway.
Oh, okay.
This is how you're standing.
I liked it. I think it's really good. I love the first one. I think this one is not as tight. It's not as like economical. It's the one thing that the first movie does that this doesn't do is it really ties the story in with the familial conflict.
Yeah.
This doesn't really do that very well. Like Syndrome and the bad guy in the first movie, he really sums up the themes of that story. But the brother and sister in this and the screenslaver, they kind of don't tie in real well with the themes, the story. And Bird he's got so many themes going on, and he's got so much stuff going on in this movie. You know, he's got the gender imbalance in the marriage. He's got the kids are growing up. He's got the media and the way that it represents superheroes. He's got all of this stuff, and it doesn't really tie together. That first movie's a bullet. This one's a bit more confused.
Right.
But that said, the action sequences in it are awesome. I'm not going to try to tell you that this movie isn't super exciting and fun to watch. I just don't think it's as well written as the first film.
Yeah, you're right. The first one is much tighter because I think Screenslaver feels very much more like a villain of the week
Yeah.
than like an interesting character like Syndrome in the first film.
I think it's a huge mistake that he didn't age the characters.
I hadn't thought about that. That's.
I think that if Violet and Dash had been teenagers, or you know, he didn't have to be 14 years later, but older, and the
like
couple
they did
is,
with Toy Story 3.
Yeah, and the couple is still sort of having the same domestic issue, but the kids are now out on their own,
yeah.
And they're more reflective of some maybe more modern sensibility, and that familial conflict gets a different dynamic. Instead, Violet is still pining after the exact same boy. Dash still wants to run fast, but no one will let him.
Yeah. And Jack Jack's still Jack Jack.
Although, you know, the baby fights a raccoon, and that's the best
that's
part of the movie.
The best part of the film is the raccoon fight.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
It won't spoil anything for you.
I was like, it's okay. I expect spoilers when I come in to talk film. But I will say that, like, as you know, I ran my first half marathon recently, so I didn't really have a life outside of all of my jobs and also training for a half. So I'm just now catching up on films this last week. And so Incredibles 2 is still on the docket for me to see this weekend. But I have heard something similar about what you're describing in it. But I wonder if, do you think that they did it because of when they set the very first Incredibles movie? Because a lot of people don't realize that the first Incredibles movie is supposedly set in the 60s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'm wondering whether or not like that's why they chose to focus the story on that gender imbalance more than anything else, is because around that time frame was when women were really stepping out of the home. It was when the way that a child grew up, I think, changed dramatically in the 10 years or so that followed the 60s, that maybe if they had aged the kids up, there would have been too much of a dramatic shift between the two. Because with Toy Story, yeah, Andy's older, but the story is still focused around the toys, which don't age. Mm-hmm. So if things are aging around the toys, it doesn't really distract or pull from the story. And I wonder if because of when they set the timeline up in the first movie, if they had aged out the characters, there would have been such a huge shift in what was going on socially that maybe it would have distracted from the actual story of the family members.
That's really interesting because I never thought of those movies being set in the 60s. I just thought it was a design aesthetic.
It's a beautiful design.
It's gorgeous. And it carries across all of Bird's other films. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was just the way that it looked.
Right.
Huh.
But that would make more sense.
Well, that being said, of the two of you who have seen the film, where do you put this? Is this a theater? Is this a rent? Is this a skip? I mean, where do you put this in the category?
It's a theater for me. I think it's, you know, if you love these kind of films, it's perfect for you.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Do you have kids?
No. I have kids that I know of.
That's also a strong point there, Tim. Yes, yes. All right. Moving along, Ocean's 8 comes out as well, or actually came out, made a bit of a splash. Matt, set this one up for us. Tee this up.
Ocean's 8 is the fourth Ocean's movie. This one is sort of headed by an all-female cast with Sandra Bullock playing George Clooney's character's sister from the old Steven Soderbergh movies. This one's directed by Gary Ross, who is Steven Soderbergh's good buddy. And it's about Sandra Bullock's character getting out of prison and deciding to get revenge on the con man who put her there by staging a huge heist at the Met Gala.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the nuts and bolts of it is we've got smart women doing smart things, making a big heist getaway. And this actually garnered a lot of attention specifically for that. A lot of people were saying, this was an interesting spin on things where maybe Ghostbusters got a lot of blowback. This actually garnered a lot of traction.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think about this?
About the movie?
Well, that yes, sure.
Both.
I thought it was fine. I mean, there is a line in the film where they're talking about recruiting a man, and I don't know who says it, but they say, like, yeah, well, that's going to draw attention. Like, no one's going to see us because they don't really pay attention to
us. Oh, I love that.
Which is very true, which I've always thought was, like, an interesting premise for, like, a spy film. Like, having a female assassin makes sense because people are so dismissive of women that they would just ignore a pretty girl walking around in a dress and not think she's here to murder somebody.
They wanted a nobody, so they get, like, Tammy or whatever her name is or something like that.
Right. The movie was, I thought it was fun. You know, my friend Jessica really had a problem with the fact that they were stealing diamonds because she was like, who does that? I don't understand in 2018 who thinks it's profitable to steal diamonds.
As opposed to just stealing like straight cash.
Yeah.
Or is he going to steal Bitcoin?
Yeah, like, I don't know what else you're going to steal, but like the idea that you're stealing diamonds seemed very outdated for 2018.
Huh. I hadn't thought of that through.
I think that's the least of the movie's problems.
Well, where do the problems come in for you?
I think it's all stylistic. I think all the actresses are fantastic in it. I really like Anne Hathaway. I think the way that she's used is really funny. I wish she'd actually played herself as opposed to some actress. Mm-hmm. But
I kind of feel like she did pair.
I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. She might as well. I just feel like just call her Anne Hathaway. I mean, Ocean's 12 did that bit with Julia Roberts. Just do it.
Not talk about that.
Yeah. But I think that the problems with this one are just stylistic. It's not directed very well. Gary Ross is no Steven Soderbergh. Uh-huh. He doesn't have it doesn't have that loose feel where you always know you're in the hands of something that's tightly constructed, even though you're not noticing it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he tries to do stuff. I kept watching this movie waiting for those details to come out. There are scenes where the characters are like maybe talking on the phone, and there's like a board in the back with all these names written on it and details of the heist, and you're sitting there going like, I should be looking at that because that's where the twist is going to be towards the end. And it just sort of never comes.
Right.
There is a twist. Of course, there always is. But it's very boring. It's just sort of like, well, while we were doing this, we were also doing that. And it doesn't really come together. The characters are all fun to watch, but they mostly don't interact or get their big moments. Mm-hmm. There are whole chunks of this movie where two of the characters are doing something important and the rest of them are all in a room just watching it on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
You know, you never get the sense that all of these little pieces that maybe you're not perceiving are coming into place while you're not looking.
100%. And I think that the biggest thing for me was the separation of the characters. Like you're saying, that a lot of this heist really seemed centered on Cate Blanchett or Sandra Bullock's characters. And the other teams were just pawns in that. Whereas I feel like in at least the original Ocean's movies, like they invested in the backstories of these characters. They gave you a preview of what they were known for before it was just like, oh, let's introduce you to this person and tell you what they're known for. Like they did flashbacks, they did scenes where they gave examples of where their skills or their traits were. Whereas in this movie, I just felt like it was more like, we need your skill. Mm-hmm. Give us your skill. We've used your skill. Here's your payment.
Right.
And as far as the diamond thing, though, mm-hmm. I kind of see it almost in the exact opposite way because the dollar's value fluctuates. Like it's a piece of paper that we've said has intrinsic value but doesn't actually hold value. Mm-hmm. And I guess the same could be said for really anything. You know, we can go back to bartering if we really wanted to. But gems are found valuable around the world, mm-hmm. whereas the U.S. dollar around the world may not hold the same kind of value. Mm-hmm. Not to mention tracing a diamond is completely different than tracing a wad of cash because they all have tracking numbers on them.
Right. I was going to say, unless it's got some sort of etched in cereal or something
which
like that.
Which they could, but you can easily laser those off.
Right. Are you lasering diamonds in your free time? What's going on?
Only with the
I'm
the
a female
secret,
assassin. You'll never see me coming.
with the secretive world of diamond smuggling. So, oh, okay.
Wait, I have a question.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you this question.
I don't know if I want to answer it.
No, it's good. Did you think it was weird that they got Sarah Paulson's character because they needed a fence, but she doesn't do that? She gets hired at Vogue instead.
They made a choice when it came to Sarah Paulson because the heist would not have worked without her character. And the fact that she is a mom-like character, I think, is in a way a fence itself.
Mm-hmm.
It makes her unassuming. It makes her at Vogue very blendable. She does get dismissed. She mm-hmm. is a very background character, but a character that, because she has that mom personality, they give her a ton of responsibility for somebody that they just randomly hired.
Yeah.
And so I do feel like the fence term probably is a little looser in this movie than it should have been or than we would have expected, but I don't think it necessarily was wrong for them to use her for that because of that mom charm that she has.
Yeah.
Sidebar though, the best part of this whole movie were every single one of Cate Blanchett's costumes. I want an entire display dedicated to those outfits and that I want to personally wear them. Every single thing that she rocked in this movie was beautifully done, down to the detail, like jewelry, makeup, hairstyle, because she had one cut, but they rocked it in like 37 different ways without changing that wig. Mm-hmm. Shoes, flawless. Nobody could pull off moon boots the way Cate Blanchett can. Like, it was beautifully done. Now, don't get me wrong. All the dresses at the Met Gala are beautiful, too. The women look flawless and everything like that. But Cate Blanchett, top to bottom, beginning to end of the movie, even when she rides away like a total babe on that motorcycle, I'm here for it.
That was the same with Rusty in the original movies.
Makes you feel like you're wearing clothes wrong.
No, I mean, but
Rusty was always eating the entire time.
As someone who loved those films, he was always in a nice suit. Always. Always in
a
nice
suit.
It's like
the same tan suit for like
four
movies.
Rewatch the movies. He was always in a nice suit.
So where does this fit in the Ocean's cadre? Like, I am not as up to speed on the world of Ocean's in general. Where do you guys place this?
I think it goes 12, 11, 13, 8.
Huh.
Wait, what are you ranking? Are you saying
that's
like
just an order of preference?
Oh, of preference.
That's like, I think 12 is the best
you
one.
You put 12?
It's one of my favorites. I know it's a weird opinion, but I think the movie's great.
I'd go 11, 12, 8, 13.
I would do 11, 8, 13, 12.
Wow. Hmm. Okay.
Okay. And my experience is 8. That's all. I've seen none of the oceans.
How?
Right? See, you would think.
Have you seen the Atlantic Ocean?
I was literally just about to be like, well, there's the Pacific right outside.
I've seen the Pacific. I've seen the Atlantic, but I haven't seen any of the Clooney's. I haven't seen any of the Sinatra, none of that.
You don't have to
the
watch
Sinatra
that.
One's good. It's more notorious than it is good.
Yes.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
See, and there is a blind spot in the viewing world, and that's one of them. So I got a couple of them. So that's one. So, but okay, Ocean's 8 overall for you guys. Is this a theater rent or a skip, Tim?
It's a rent.
Okay.
It's a rent.
All right, Aaron?
If you're into costuming,
yeah.
Total theater.
Okay.
Otherwise, rent.
Okay. So I'll put you down for a theater on that one.
Matt? Yeah, I got to go rent.
Okay. And I'm going in the rental category as well. I had a lot of fun with this. But the one thing I noticed specifically is that the makeup actually did stand out for me on all the women. I was kind of like, and sometimes they do a nude makeup that looks very just natural. Mm-hmm. But in this, I could tell they were all wearing their makeup. And I almost didn't want to on some of them. And I was like, I wish they thought that through a little differently. So while the costuming, yes, spot on. Makeup, I run question. So that brings us to the work of Mr. Fred Rogers and Won't You Be My Neighbor? This is one that a number of us had a chance to catch up with at SIFF. And this basically looks into the life and the lessons of the legendary icon of children's television. And that would be Fred Rogers. And this is from director Morgan Neville, the same person who brought us, was it 20 Feet from Stardom?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And offering up the new touching and reassuring, kind of the heartwarming documentary told from the perspective of a number of the family members, as well as some of the actors and crew on the show, and really helping to paint Rogers as the man who walked his talk, effectively communicating, showing love, respecting, and sort of teaching his philosophies and moral codes, all with a kind hand the whole time. And I will say, I don't know how many, if we were all in the same theater on this one.
I haven't seen this one.
Okay.
Yeah. We all
were. Yeah, we're all there.
Think of a room of hardened critics, you know, the toughest of the tough. I don't think there was a single dry eye in the entire theater when we all walked out. And, you know, there's the rep, they're trying to take your comments. Like, what'd you think? I'm like, hold on, I need a tissue. This is one of those films that hits, to me, all of the heartstrings and played them so delicately, but so accurately, really kind of reminding us as viewers the goodness and the kindness, but also it's sort of one of those, here's the long way around on this story. There's a reason why people cry after romance films. And one of the speculations on that is the fact that when there's a romance film, people cry at the end because they are aspiring to something they will never attain or never get, and therefore they're feeling that sense of loss.
Ooh, that's dark.
Right? But yeah. That's one of the speculations. And I think that there may be some truth to it. And I think that may be some of the truth of what's going on in Won't You Be My Neighbor? Because you look back to your childhood and you go, God, yeah, I believed I wanted this. And it turned out like this. And you're feeling so let down. Thoughts?
We didn't deserve him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this generation doesn't deserve him.
Yeah.
And I think that especially the way that the movie showed how the ending of his life, it started to get a lot harder for him, especially after 9/11. I truly don't think that if Mr. Rogers had existed for this generation, he would have been Mr. Rogers. There's a lot more evil in this world today. And there's a lot more apparent evil
in
this
world
today. That I think it just would have broken his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. The thing that struck me that I don't remember as, because I watched it a bunch as a child, but I didn't remember like all of the very serious stuff he put in his show. Like the first week they're talking about King Friday trying to build a wall to keep people out. And it's airing during the Vietnam War and all this stuff is happening. It's the first week of the show. And he sort of handled it like a grown up talking to children, but not in a child's voice.
And not talking down to children.
Yeah, talking to children, not down to them. And it was fascinating. And he continued to do that for years. Year after year, he would do it. And it was fascinating. Similar to what Aaron's saying, I don't know if he could exist now. That was sort of the sad part. It was like, gosh, this would be great to have, but I don't know if people could even digest what he's doing now.
I don't think they would appreciate it either.
Yeah.
And I wonder if in our political climate today, if people could handle that, even though he was handling so much stuff so gingerly.
Now, in the film, there's a clip towards the end.
Right.
And Aaron gave me the evil eye when this happened. It's like an hour plus of Mr. Rogers and how beautiful he is. And
then
she was shaking. It cuts to a news clip of them saying Mr. Rogers has ruined this generation because he told all these children they were special.
Right.
And it's just like, that's not it.
Yeah.
That's not the way we want to go with this. But that's exactly what would have happened.
But do you also remember, like, there was a point I remember in my life when as a kid, watching Mr. Rogers, loving Mr. Rogers, Trolley, Land of Make-Believe, all of that, Lady and Lady Fairchild, all of that, there came a time in my miscreant youth, right, where I turned my back on Mr. Rogers and I became, you know, kind of the juvenile delinquent, and you know, you're snide, and you don't really, Mr. Rogers, who would want to, you know, there was that time at least in my life where Mr. Rogers was kind of like, oh God, go stand over there. I don't need this in my life. And I have since done an about face on that.
Yeah.
But there was, and they bring this up in the film, there's that point where there's that questioning of, are you for real? Like, are you this real guy? Is this really your message? And there was that point where he came under fire. I wonder about this as well, where kind of playing into the point and the questions of, this was the man,
right?
But I don't know. I've kind of lost my train of thought on this altogether.
No, but I think what you're saying is, like, there will be a time when you grow up, as you're growing up, because we've all done it, where there's certain lessons that you seem to think aren't useful anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're an adult, you revisit them because they're very useful. And for myself, I think about my nephews and my nieces, and whether I need Mr. Rogers or not, I know they need him.
Mm-hmm.
And I revisited as an adult that those lessons and that compassion, that love for people. But in their youth, my nephew as a kid, like, he needs that lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's not getting that from Blue's Clues or anything else?
He needs that lesson. And every kid growing up will need that lesson. And it's a lesson that we keep having to give children because they need it. So even if it's not useful to me, or I've turned my back, or I've have some other obsession that's not Mr. Rogers, I know there's a whole generation of kids who need that lesson. And hopefully when they're adults, they'll revisit it again.
Yeah. Any other thoughts, Aaron?
I have a lot of thoughts on this movie. Tim knows, you don't know. like, I battle severe depression, PTSD, and generalized anxiety. So for me, there's a lot of comfort that comes from movies like this, and there was always comfort that came from his show because he tackled real world issues in ways that kids may not have understood the real world issue that he was confronting about, but they understood the underlying message and they carried that with him. And I have yet to find a single story of somebody interacting with Mr. Rogers outside of that show, in public or in any setting, even just one-offs that had nothing to do with press or publicity or anything like that, that does not say that he was exactly that human.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine my life, like, having known that I didn't actually grow up when his show was on the air, I still can't imagine my life without the lessons that he taught me. And it's hard to carry those lessons every day now because of how the real world beats us down, it feels like. And you know, that message, you know, about the guy saying that he ruined this generation because he told kids that they were special, you know, it goes back to the participation medal argument that a lot of parents have. And I came at my dad actually about this because he mentioned it last Thanksgiving. And I told him, I was like, you know, we as kids never asked for the participation medals. Our parents did. We had no say in the matter. We just wanted to play. And so I feel like when comments like that come, it comes from a parent or an adult feeling evil about a situation that has actually nothing to do with a child. And it's coming from a root of selfishness more than anything else. And I've said it a million times, but I truly believe that the root of all evil in this world is selfishness. Mm-hmm. Everything that people do for an evil purpose comes from that root of selfishness. And a person like Mr. Rogers that truly seems to be so pure and so genuine, people don't believe can exist, so they immediately want to destroy or attack it. And that hurts my heart a lot because I know how bitter and cynical I am, but I still believe in the beauty that Mr. Rogers was. And I hope that those of us who do believe in that beauty carry that to our children more than anything else, since they don't have a Mr. Rogers to watch nowadays.
Well said.
Well said.
Yeah, I haven't even seen it. I think you're absolutely right.
So, bringing this one kind of in, I think we're all going to say theater
one. It's a theater, and it's my lock for best documentary this year. Academy Awards. It's definitely going to win.
I said, if you see one, see this one, because holy smokes, this one, if there's anything that could make a room of hardened
I mean,
critics.
This review sounds sad, but it's really a feel-good movie.
It really is.
It's not like, you're not going to walk out super sad.
Yeah, no. In fact,
we can't predict that.
Right, you might, but I think this is more on the uplifting scale where it is a reminder of there is good and there can be good, and here's an example of that. So that's where I take that. Want to shift gears on this 180 degrees now to something that's loud, raucous, rumbles, and like causes glasses of water to shake and things to appear larger than the rearview mirror.
There.
You see where I'm going with this?
Yes.
Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Aaron, set it up.
All right. Anyone that knows me knows that I have a pure and unabashed love for dinosaurs. So we pick up with the story of Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. It is 3 years after the Indominus Rex destroyed Jurassic World. The dinosaurs that survived that attack have all kind of just been left alone on the island to roam and eat each other or eat the plants. But the island off the coast of Costa Rica is about to erupt. The volcano at the center is rumbling and all the dinosaurs must die. So there's a large debate whether or not they should save the dinosaurs or let them become extinct because the universe is trying to balance itself out in some way. And we pick up with Bryce Dallas Howard's character, who has been approached by a man representing the, is it Lockheed? Lockhart?
Lockwood.
I knew it was something. Lockwood Estate. He used to be a partner of the original Jurassic Park creator, John Hammond, RIP, stating that they want to rescue the dinosaurs that they can, place them on another island as a sanctuary, and just let them live out their lives. So Claire has been tasked with going to get Owen Grady, or Chris Pratt's character, to go rescue Blue and the remaining dinosaurs. Claire's needed because her handprint is the only thing that can access the tracking system. So they very quickly, like 30 minutes into the movie, arrive on the island, start rescuing the dinosaurs, only to, shocker, find out that not everything is as it seems.
Chaos ensues.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
People never learn, apparently.
Yeah, and the tall man, what's his name? Oh, come on now.
Jeff
Goldblum.
I was like, my love, Jeff Goldblum? Yeah, better not forget his name.
The tall man.
The tall
man. He's tall, because he is tall. He's a man who's physically imposing. He's a tall man. He's a tall drink of water with a silver beard now. But as you're right, as Goldblum explains, this is, nature finds a way. It always finds a way. And life finds a way. That's his line, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it's life finds a way.
Right. This time without the oops. Different film. But nonetheless, still just as entertaining. The idea here, this film, that we can pick up this franchise after it started, what, 1993?
Three.
Here we are now, flash forward 25 years. Did I do the math on that right? 25 years? 25 years later. And we're still relevant with this. What are you guys' thoughts on this? Is this still making sense? Is this still selling tickets? Is this still drawing audiences in for a new story? Or is it that it's we're revisiting all the things that we loved from 93?
So there will never be a 93 again, ever. And every movie that has come out since then has severely fallen short, in my opinion. Score still remains beautiful, but the storylines are... Nobody learns at all. And so like even in my review that I posted, I said, if you want to see the exact same film that's been produced five times before, then this is the perfect film for you.
Yeah.
On top of that, this whole movie felt like a bridge film. This entire movie was a setup for whatever is going to come in the third installment. Mm-hmm. And I can't stand when movies do that. There was really no substance in this film except for there are dinosaurs in the world now. What do we do?
Yeah. Matrix 2 syndrome. Okay.
Well, that's a whole other thing. You don't want me to get involved in the Matrix 2 thing.
No, but again, the bridge,
she's right.
Yeah. Matt, you had a chance to catch up with this, yes?
I think these movies have an extremely low bar to clear. Like, I loved that first one when it came out. I really think Lost World is really good, too. But all I really care about, the only thing I'm there to see is dinosaurs chasing and eating people. That's it. Yep. I don't care. This movie failed to clear that bar. It's
really
insanely boring. There's not that much dinosaur stuff in it. You guys had one job. And like this, I don't want to spoil too much, but the second half of this movie is they put the dinosaurs in a basement and then one of them chases a little girl in a house. That's not what I came here for.
Mm-hmm.
You can say what you want about Jurassic World. It's you know, not very well directed. It's not the most imaginative movie I've ever seen, but it has constant dinosaurs chewing on people. It's violent and it's got a mean streak. It's a lot of fun. This was just flat in so many ways, despite being like visually interesting in a marginal way, more than the other one, than the last one. But man, I was falling asleep in this thing.
Yeah. And it wasn't because the theater was overheating.
Oh my God, we were all sweltering in there.
That was, yeah, they didn't turn the AC on.
It's 4DX. You're supposed to feel the volcanic.
I felt like I was in Costa Rica.
Yeah, you're supposed to feel that.
Yeah, but even the volcano thing, like they've got a volcano blowing up. It's throwing giant flaming rocks into the sky. Mm-hmm. You can't even get me one of these commando dudes getting pancaked by a rock. They couldn't even do that for me.
They got pancaked by like the stampeding dinosaurs, but I agree, like overall, you really only have one job in a Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah.
And while I feel like this film definitely fell short of that job, it just, like, the whole movie was just one big setup for a twist that was really subpar. Like, they threw in a Hail Mary three quarters of the way through the movie that involved Lockwood's granddaughter.
In air quotes.
Yeah, that was air. Sorry, I always forget that. I'm on
radio. No one can see us.
Nobody can see that.
I saw your air quotes. I saw.
And, like, it was a Hail Mary pass that was completely fumbled and lost all resonance and made absolutely no sense. And then they bled that subplot into a reasoning as to why the dinosaurs now have been released upon the world and that we just have to figure out how to live with them.
And
to me, that's the thing that really irked me the most.
Mm-hmm.
If this spoiler is to be real, what's the point of what they're doing? That the spoiler is the profitable thing you should be doing, not like a dinosaur auction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have so many like concerns with what kind of Noah's Ark they use to transport these dinosaurs, how quick they got from Costa Rica to wherever they're at in the United States.
Less than 24 hours.
Yeah, it's like a nap, and they wake up and it's like, oh, we're here. And no one can even hear. We talked about this before we started recording.
Yeah.
No one hears these dinosaurs moving around.
Yeah, this is the king of that.
They're dinosaurs. Like, the T-Rex sneaks up on people multiple times.
Yeah, no one can hear anything that's not on the frame in this movie.
Yet it can still
shake. Can you imagine a T-Rex sneaking up on you?
Well, I can't. I'm pretty stupid. It can probably happen to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that. So it's the whole movie's kind of crazy, but the last act is a bit of a mess.
Yeah. All right. So real quick on this one, sounds like you guys are lukewarm, if at best, on this. Tim, where are you coming in on this?
Oh, it's a skip.
A skip for Tim. Aaron, how about you?
I'm still going to say theater.
Oh,
whoa.
I have to. It's dinosaurs. It's Jurassic Park. Like, you can't see, like, if you rent this movie and watch it at home, the aesthetics of it will be lost on you. Yeah. So
you could always turn it off, though.
If you just want to go for popcorn and sit down and watch dinosaurs kind of eat people.
Sure. Yeah.
I no longer trust capitalism. I'm going to say rent just because maybe if the box office is bad, they'll do something better with the next one.
Ah, okay. And I'll back that play as well. I'll go with you on the rent as well. So I got a theater, two rents, and a skip on Jurassic World, The Fallen Kingdom. So Matt, you actually come to us from Scarecrow Video.
Yes.
And we were talking before we started on all this. 30 years with Scarecrow Video, or for Scarecrow. You have not, Matt, you have not been involved with Scarecrow for 30 years.
No, 15.
Right. That's a good run in its own right, though.
15 in a couple of months.
Holy smokes. Wow. So tell us a little bit about this. I mean, and for folks who are just kind of getting in the know and want to know more about what Scarecrow is, what Scarecrow does, tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, Scarecrow Video is the biggest, I don't want to say video store, we're the biggest sort of media, like home video archive in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 131,000 titles. And if you want to put that into some kind of perspective, think about how many titles you think, say, Netflix has. It's like between 3,000 and 5,000.
Yeah.
If you take Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and put them all together, you get about 55,000. So we have more than double what you can get anywhere else.
Right.
We turned nonprofit in 2014.
Yeah.
And since then, we've been able to keep the archive available to the public. We've been able to utilize volunteer labor, sell memberships, take donations. We fundraise pretty frequently. We're fundraising right now. And the goal is basically to keep the community, keep the collection available to the community so anybody can walk in and see any one of these movies they want.
What exactly are the formats that you're dealing with here, too? Because I remember as a college kid going to Scarecrow, and this was over 20 years ago because I was doing film criticism, we had to pick old films to look at and kind of pick apart. And so I actually chose the original King Kong, of which I could find, like, at the time it was a VHS, and you had to put a deposit down on that VHS because it was worth, like, a gajillion dollars.
Yeah, yeah. We still have a lot of that stuff.
So is it all still VHS and DVD, or what are the formats?
I mean, VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, we still have some Laserdiscs. We still have about 15,000 VHS tapes. Now, we don't have those tapes because we think tapes are neat.
Yeah.
We have those tapes because those movies never made it to DVD.
Gotcha.
You know, if one of them comes out on DVD, we'll sell the tape.
Sure.
But we have those movies because those are the only ways, that's the only way it's available.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, we still have a lot of movies that have a significant deposit, and it's not necessarily because it's worth a jillion dollars, but it is because, you know, it's going to be hard to replace if it gets lost or damaged or stolen or something like that. Yeah.
Got you. How did you even get started at Scarecrow?
You know, I've worked in video stores and bookstores my whole adult life. I moved to Seattle in 2003, needed a job. There was a big video store, so I needed something quick. So I put in my resume. They hired me pretty much on the spot, and I never left.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what's going on here. 30 years, you say you're doing some fundraising with Scarecrow right now. What does that entail?
Right now, we are fundraising. We've been fundraising for a couple months. It's sort of a yearly thing. We're trying to raise $100,000. We're about $65,000 into that, so we're over the halfway mark.
Yeah.
The idea is basically a couple of things. First of all, to, as I said, keep the collection available and open to the public. You don't need to belong to any kind of institution to rent from us. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is that we want to have that money to keep doing our community outreach programs. Like, we have a program where we take movies to senior homes and show them movies and have discussions with them. We have a children's hour where kids can come and do activities. We're starting to try to do a thing where we have an educational outreach where teachers can use the store as a resource, and we can maybe go into their classes and help them with that. There are a lot of, you know, we kind of look at ourselves like KEXP or KUOW or public radio in general. Like, this is a community resource. Those organizations have to fundraise, like SIF, you know, twice a year. And so we're sort of following that model.
So if somebody wants to donate money, how do they do that? Where do they go?
There are lots of ways you can do it. You can do it in the store. You can do it on Facebook. You can buy a membership, which gives you access to early access to sales. You get discounts on rentals, things like that. You can go to our GoFundMe page. This is where we're doing our fundraiser right now, which is GoFundMe.com/3030yearsofscarecrow. There's all kinds of cool rewards on the GoFundMe. You can get, like, t-shirts, hats. You can program movies in our screening room. You can curate your own section. You can sponsor specific titles. There's all kinds of cool stuff you can get that way.
Yeah. My friend used to live off of 50th, so I would walk in there a lot, and it was really a good place to find foreign films. But I always saw very interesting characters when I went in there.
Yeah.
Do you have an interesting story to tell about I know this is a PG-13 show, but any interesting stories to tell about something that's happened at the store?
You know, probably the most famous story, which actually happened before I got there, was that Quentin Tarantino was in town, and he walked from downtown to the store just to see it. Yeah.
Wow.
I wish I'd have been there.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Is there ever like a Dale Chihuly moment where Dale has to come in? He's like, I'm looking for this.
You know what? I haven't seen Dale in a long time, but he used to be semi-regular customer. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's of the customers that you get in, though, how many are just the pedestrians looking for, you know, I don't know, looking for Spider-Man 2 versus the looking for film noir, digging deep, going into the archives?
I'd say it's about 50-50. You know, we have people who come in there every week, pick up the newest releases, but we also have people who come in there looking for one specific thing, you know, and it varies. We also have people, like, the vast majority of people are coming in there just like, we heard this place was cool, what's a good movie?
Yeah.
You know, and we're always happy to find out what they're interested in and show them around and maybe give them something that they didn't know that they wanted.
Right. So how, I guess I'm trying to picture the sheer volume of video that you guys have there. What is the archive purpose, or like, not purpose, but what is the format? Like, how are you keeping all of this shelved? And I mean, this is sounding like Trinity Library to me. This is sounding enormous.
Well, I mean, we're constantly in a battle with space.
Yeah.
We used to actually have a third floor where like our offices and stuff were.
Right.
And we stored all the VHS upstairs. But,
oh, no.
But we had the, when the previous owners sold the business and we went nonprofit.
Yeah.
They sold the building, and this really great tabletop gaming company that's the owner is a longtime fan of ours, moved in upstairs. So we had to take all of our stuff off the third floor and compact it downstairs.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, everything is really tight. All of the tapes are on big rollers, like custom-built rollers that we made for ourselves, stored in the back behind the counter. We used to keep the DVDs and Blu-rays in plastic cases in the back, but we ran out of space for that, so now they're all in paper sleeves. So sure. We have to shift them into plastic cases when we rent them to people. And it's a constant battle with space. Yeah. Many, many sections have been compressed. We've taken – like we probably have, I don't know, let's call it 5,000 to 8,000 sports titles, documentaries on all kinds of different sports. Baseball, basketball, yes, but also, you know, like pro wrestling. We have a whole bunch of movies that are about jump ropes. We had to take all that stuff out and put them into plastic sleeves just so we could – make space.
Yeah.
It's like finding room for all of that stuff is a huge struggle. And we're adding between 3,000 and 5,000 movies a year. A lot of people think that our inventory is static.
Yeah.
But it's not. We're still getting new releases every single week.
Ooh.
Wow.
So do you have a favorite genre that you like to kind of thumb through and pick through? And
I mean, specifically my favorite straight genre is probably spaghetti westerns.
Oh, yeah?
But also I'm a huge fan of exploitation from the 60s, 70s, 80s. Right. That's sort of been the focus of my energies as far as a cinephile goes.
Sure.
But yep. I'll watch anything.
Do you have a favorite from those exploitation films?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think my favorite is one of two. My favorite blaxploitation film is a movie called Truck Turner with Isaac Hayes.
Yes. I'm familiar with Truck Turner.
I think that is absolutely the best blaxploitation movie, mostly because he plays kind of an interesting character. Like, he's not the coolest guy in the room.
No.
He's kind of a dummy sometimes. And you know, the whole thing, like, you know, you're used to a movie like Shaft or whatever, where he's like, no one understands him but his woman. But he cannot get along with his woman. Like, she gets out of jail, and she's in jail because he basically ended up, like, he did something and she took the rap for him.
Yeah.
And she gets out of prison and he shows up like to pick her out of jail and he's like got a 6-pack and some fried chicken. It's fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Excuse me. It's terrible. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of that movie is so cool because it has all the flamboyant stuff that you expect from a blaxploitation, you know, like the crazy characters, the clothes, the karate kicks, but it's also like this really gritty LA movie.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Jackie Brown actually came from that movie. Like, I don't know if you remember Jackie Brown, but there's a story he tells of Pam Grier where he's like sitting in a dude's house and the whole house smells like cat pee because the guy's got too many cats around. Yeah. That story is a story that Truck Turner tells in that movie. He like lifted it straight out of that.
No kidding.
Yeah, there's all kinds of little references, of course, in a Tarantino movie
to
other stuff. Yeah. But that's what really put me in the mood for that one. And I think it's really, really exceptional. My other favorite exploitation movie is a women in prison film called The Mothers, M-U-T-H-E-R-S. And it's not like the Big Dollhouse or the Big Birdcage where it's like, a bunch of ladies get thrown in the clink and there's like a slimy warden and everything. It's about how these women deliberately go undercover into the skeeviest jungle prison in order to bust it out from the inside.
Wow.
And in the middle of the movie, they blow the place up and they run out into the jungle and it turns into a revenge action movie. It was directed by a guy named Chirio Santiago, who is one of the great Roger Corman acolytes. He made a lot of movies in the Philippines and sold them to Roger Corman.
Wow.
It's a terrific movie.
That sounds crazy.
It's awesome. You got to see it.
Wow. And that was Mothers. What was it? Tough Mothers?
The Mothers.
The Mothers.
But Mothers is spelled with a U, not an
like,
O.
Like as in like mother.
Yeah, the
as
Mothers.
In, like, heavy.
It's great.
So, man. Well, so Scarecrow turning 30. Folks want to make those donations. They can do that because you guys are raising money. And again, what was the source on that? The
best place to go is to our GoFundMe page, which is gofundme.com/3030yearsofscarecrow.
Yes.
All one word.
Man, it sounds like there is a lot going on. So that is ultimately very, very cool. In quick review, because we're running a little shy on time here at this point, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom getting a theater recommendation, two rental recommendations, and a skip. Ocean's 8 getting a theater recommendation and 3 rental recommendations. Incredibles 2 getting 2 theater recommendations. and Won't You Be My Neighbor 3 theater recommendations from the Squabblers. Real quick, are you guys working on any other projects? Matt, how about you?
No, I have to go to work right now.
Oh, that sounds like a plan. Aaron, how about you?
Always working on Etsy orders and writing as much as I can.
And Tim?
Just a bunch of movies. That's it.
Excellent. Well, Cinema Squabble, episode number 76, Tim Hall, Aaron Hunley, Matt Lynch, Adam Gerke, thanks so much for joining us. You can find us at cinemasquabble.com. You can find us on Stitcher. You can give us the thumbs up, the stars, the likes, all of the above. And thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer.